This is Michael Palmieri, former radio syndication manager for Economic Update, bringing you an exclusive Democracy at Work field report. This week, this report takes place at Washington, D.C.'s March for Climate, Justice, and Jobs, which surprised organizers when it drew over 200,000 people into the streets, all demanding action on climate change now. What follows is a sampling of voices and sounds from the streets on one of the hottest April 29ths in D.C. history.
Loud.
Yeah.
The timing.
It's all right. We'll get a little bit.
Let's start a chant.
Do you want to describe, first give me your name and describe the sign you're holding?
Yes, my name is Greg Hammer. I'm from Miami, Economic Ground Zero for Sea Level Rise. So I'm the group leader of the what we call the Ground Zero chapter of Citizens Climate Lobby. And in the sign that I'm holding, it's simply a news report from fall when the king tides come to Miami, when the moon is closer to the earth every fall, where we have the bigger high tides, and this is an example of sea level rise. And what happened is an octopus famously came up through a sewer drain into a parking garage in Miami Beach. And I am dressed up as said angry washed up cephalopod to call attention.
I see that. Yeah, you're wearing a, like a purple octopus.
Purple octopus in a hard hat. Whatever it takes, buddy.
So one of the reasons I jumped over here, you were talking about the intersection between ecological, I guess you could either say destruction or thriving.
Let me make it clear. We call it the triple bottom line. In the corporate world, the triple bottom line essentially means people, planet, and profit. We need to balance financial performance with social performance and ecological performance. We have to have economic solutions with equity and not forgetting about the economy. And this is known as the triple bottom line. Again, people, planet, and profit is a good way to
good way to
think about it.
Yeah.
All three need to work. And whatever then, solutions need to work for those three.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to ask you if you could speak a little bit. When a lot of people think about environmental issues, environmental movement, they kind of juxtapose as a complete opposite, job creation.
Right.
Can you talk about how the two actually don't have to be in contradiction with one another, but can actually be?
Yes, I'd like to speak about that. There is a fear on behalf, particularly of conservatives, to acknowledge, talk about, or seek any solutions around climate change. The problem is that they don't really have a problem with the science. They have a problem with the solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Until they are disabused of the myth that any solutions must result in bigger government, taking away our freedoms, killing the economy, and making us poor, because those are the fears, we're not going to get anywhere. And the reality is there is a solution that would help the economy. It would put people to work. It's been economically modeled to create 2.8 million jobs. We're talking about a carbon fee and dividend, which is put forth by Citizens Climate Lobby. And there are many other groups that are calling for a revenue-neutral carbon tax or fee. We like to call it a fee because, well, two reasons. The T word freaks people out. And number two, you shouldn't call it a tax if the government doesn't keep it. And the carbon fee and dividend is a 100% refund back to American citizens to protect us from increasing prices. So it's a fee, a dividend, and a border adjustment we won't get into at this venue now. A little too wonky for our situation at the moment. But there is a solution that would create jobs, promote American ingenuity and competition, put America to work, save 13,000 lives. It is a small government, fiscally conservative, market-based solution. That's music, should be music to the ears of any principled conservative, and it also would draw down emissions faster than any policy that you have ever heard of, certainly faster than any regulation. And I'm not saying we don't need certain protections, but in fact, if there's a market-based solution that would blow past certain regulations or protections, wouldn't you be for that?
Yeah, right. So absolutely. One last thing before it gets too loud again.
Yeah.
You were talking before about a bipartisan commission.
Yes, a caucus.
A caucus. You want to explain a little bit about what's going on there?
Yes, one of the things CCL, Citizens Climate Lobby, does is our motto is bridging the partisan divide on climate. We meet with Republicans and Democrats regularly on Capitol Hill and in district offices. We form relationships with them. When you know who your representative is, that's a good thing. But when they know your name, that's a better thing. And what has happened is a bipartisan climate solutions caucus, a working group of both Democrats and Republicans. Most people don't know this has happened. It's not in the headlines. This was created February last year with Carlos Curbelo, who was at the time a freshman Republican, and a Democrat, Ted Deutsch, out of West Palm Beach. When this formed with one and one, Bloomberg News called it the Caucus to Save the World. New York Times called it a surprising step toward sanity. It grew to 2-2 and 3-3. Up until the election, it was 10-10, and then it was a bit disrupted. One person retired, people were voted out, it was 6-9. It, just weeks after the election, grew back to 10-10, 12-12. As of last count, just a couple of days ago, it's up to 19 Republicans, 19 Democrats coming to the table in a toxic-free environment to talk about economically viable solutions to the climate crisis. Mm-hmm. And this is amazing. Most people don't know this is happening, that there is, in fact, while we read the headlines and we're rightfully very upset by the disturbing news, a lot of the headlines underscore and highlight the controversy, and a lot of it is serious. But what is not on the headlines is the huge amount of momentum in Capitol Hill, in Congress particularly, among Republicans who are moving the needle, who are bucking their party, manning up and womaning up in some cases, and summoning the leadership and courage required to actually lead. And that's what we need. And that is what happens when enough people are able to develop their own personal and political power. And that's something we do at citizensclimatelobby.org. We're 60,000 volunteer members, 400 chapters as of last count. We're worldwide, but mostly North America. Big Canadian footprint. And we were very helpful in creating and promoting this caucus.
All right. Thank you, Greg.
Just after speaking with Greg Hammer, I was able to speak with Ted Glick, an environmental activist based in New Jersey. We spoke under a 12-foot cardboard structure made by a local artist. The best way to describe it was a giant billionaire banker puppet master, his head replaced by a bag of money. Under his two hands were puppet strings which attached themselves to public officials who sit on the board of FERC, the Federal Energy and Regulatory Commission. Often obscure in our conversation, Ted outlined FERC's importance and complicity in the expansion of oil and fracking pipeline construction.
I mean, we call FERC the most dangerous agency you've probably never heard of, which is really true. I mean, we saw it, you know, this is a march of people who get it on climate, on how serious the climate crisis is. And a lot of people, when we would ask them, do you know who FERC is, they would shake their heads. They didn't know. That's how FERC is able to do its damage, because they've been operating in the shadows. But as the whole fracking explosion has happened, and pipelines need to get built to ship the frack gas, mainly from Pennsylvania, as far as the Northeast, as they need pipelines and compressor stations to push the gas along, and then export terminals because they want to ship the gas all around the world where the prices are higher. They need the infrastructure for all that frack gas, the gas industry. And FERC does the bidding of the gas industry. In 30 years, they've only turned down one application for a permit for a interstate gas pipeline. Only one in 30 years. That was last year, and that was mainly because of resistance on the ground from landowners who refused to let anybody from the gas industry come onto their land to do surveys, as well as because the company that wanted to build this one pipeline that got rejected, they couldn't find any buyers for their gas. That's the reason why FERC turned it down. They're actually applying again. So when we explain this story to people, people get it. They understand that, you know, the federal government can be a corrupted entity, and definitely this agency, it's very corrupted.
But with all the attention now...
Okay, confession here. I actually kind of jumped in on someone else's interview while they were recording. So that woman you hear in the background, she's another journalist interviewing Ted. What she just asked him was, why is it that most people can draw a direct line to the fossil fuel companies like ExxonMobil or many of the other banks like Citigroup who are backing the Dakota Access Pipeline, yet they tend to overlook FERC itself? Anyway, that's what she asked, and here's what he answered.
Well, there is interest. I mean, we initiated a what's called a FERC Vacancies Coalition a couple of months ago, and there's 160 organizations that have joined that coalition. And what we're all united behind is that we actually already are opposing the three nominees that Trump is going to make to be commissioners of FERC. But almost more importantly, that we're demanding that before any new commissioners are approved, there needs to be a congressional hearing to really deal with FERC, to really look at FERC and bring it out of the shadows. See, that's the thing. The way FERC is able to do all this is because nobody knows about them. You know, they're this behind-the-scenes agency. But that's been changing. You know, a lot of it has been because of these groups that are on the receiving end of these proposals, you know, for gas infrastructure. And people have been fighting them. And there's been this movement that's been growing and developing and getting better coordinated. So things are changing that way. There's actually been four gas pipelines that have been proposed over the last little over a year that have been either rejected, in one case by FERC in Oregon, or turned down by state agencies. There's two of those in New York. Or in the case of the Kinder Morgan pipeline going up kind of from New York into New England, they withdrew. They dropped their plan because there was so much resistance at every level, from the grassroots, the state legislature, Massachusetts, U.S. senators. So we are starting to win victories. A lot of pipelines have been delayed. Lots of them have been delayed. And there's legal actions always happening. There's always legal cases going on against FERC or against these pipeline proposals. So, you know, there's a strong movement that has developed and grown over the last 4 or 5 years, and it's not going away.
And your name and where you're from?
I'm Julia Bradley Cook. I live in Washington, D.C.
Do you want to describe your sign?
Sure. So the sign is for the 500 Women Scientists organization, and we are a group of women scientists across the country, across the whole world now, actually a growing network of people who are trying to figure out how to engage as scientists in our society at large, in issues that matter now. And so many of us are climate scientists, and we know that acting on climate right now and even yesterday is of the most importance. So we've gotten together, and this particular sign shows the growth in our membership since the election.
Wow, yeah, so you see it. You guys started on November 12th?
Right. So it started around a pledge where a group of women scientists wanted to commit to each other to stay engaged and organized around how to act collectively. And so they wrote a pledge, and we're hoping to get 500 women to sign it eventually. And then, sure enough, within 2 days, 500 women signed it. And then by the end of the month, over 11,000 women had signed it. So we have nearly 20,000 signers of the pledge now, and representation across the world, and we're a growing network of people who are trying to figure out how to use our knowledge and find a way to express what we know and find solutions.
So that's it for this first installment of Democracy at Work Field Reports. If you liked what you heard, please visit democracyatwork.info, where you can find more content focusing on the economic dimensions of our daily lives. You'd also be able to contribute a donation to keep projects like this and many others going. As for field reports, our next stop will be the Left Forum in New York City. For those of you who don't know, each spring the Left Forum convenes the largest gathering in North America and the U.S. and the international left. Hopefully we'll be able to speak with some major thinkers on the topic of climate change, resistance, economic justice, and so many other topics. Thanks again for listening. I'm Mike Palmieri with Democracy at Work. Rise up. Rise up.
keep coming back.